Hey, you bought this mansion directly across the valley. You paid a lot of money and a great deal to renovate this house for that sole purpose. Is that what you're saying?
Manshiki said, Yes, that's it. This is the ideal spot to be able to observe her house. I had to get this mansion, no matter what. There was no other lot around here that I could get a building permit for, and ever since, I've been looking for her across the valley through my binoculars almost every day. Though I should say that the days I can't see her far outnumber the days I can.
So you live alone, keeping people out as much as you can, so no one interferes with that pursuit.
And Shiki nodded again. That's right. I don't want anyone to bother me. No one to disturb things. That's what I'm looking for. I need unlimited solitude. You're the only other person in the world who knows this secret. It wouldn't be good to confess this kind of delicate thing to people.
You got that right, I thought. And this thought occurred to me as well. Then why did you just tell me?
Then why did you just tell me? I asked Manshiki. Is there some special reason?
Manshiki recrossed his legs and looked straight at me. His voice was soft.
Yes, of course there's a reason. I have a special favor to ask of you.
Chapter 25. How much loneliness the truth can cause.
I have a special favor to ask of you, Manshiki said. From his tone, I guessed he'd been waiting for the right moment to bring this up, and that this was the real reason he had invited me and the Commendatore to dinner, in order to reveal his secret and bring up this request.
If it's something I can help with, of course, I said.
Manshiki gazed into my eyes and then spoke. More than something you can help with. It's something only you can help with. I was suddenly dying for a cigarette. When I got married, I used that as the incentive to stop smoking, and in the nearly 7 years since, I hadn't smoked a single cigarette. It was tough quitting. I'd been a pretty heavy smoker, but nowadays, I never had the urge. But at that instant, for the first time in forever, I thought about how great it would be to have a cigarette between my lips and light it. I could hear the scratch of the match.
What could that possibly be? I asked. Not that I particularly wanted to know. I'd prefer to get by not knowing, but the way the conversation was going, I had to ask.
Well, I'd like you to paint her portrait, Manshiki said.
In my head, I had to dismantle the context of his words, then reassemble it all. Though it was a very simple context.
You mean you want me to paint the portrait of this girl who may be your daughter?
Manshiki nodded.
Exactly. That's what I want you to do. And not from a photograph, but actually have her pose for you and paint the picture with her as the model. Have her come to your studio, like when you painted me. That's my only condition. How you paint her is up to you. Do it any way you want. I promise I won't have any other requests later on.
I was at a loss for words. Several questions immediately occurred to me, and I asked the first one that came to mind. But how can I convince the girl to do that? I might be her neighbor, but I can't very well just suggest to a young girl I don't know that I want to paint your portrait, so would you model for me?
No, of course not. That would make her suspicious for sure.
Then do you have any good ideas?
Manshiki looked at me for a time. Then, like quietly opening a door and tiptoeing into a back room of a house, he slowly opened his mouth. Actually, you already know her. And she knows you very well.
I already know her?
You do. Her name is Maria, Maria Akikawa. Aki, the character for autumn, and Kawa, river. Maria is spelled out in hiragana. You do know her, right?
Maria Akikawa. I'd heard the name before, but it felt like some temporary obstruction was keeping me from putting name and face together. Finally, the pieces fell into place. I said, Maria Akikawa is in my children's art class in Odawara, isn't she?
Menshiki nodded. That's right. Exactly. You're her painting teacher.
Maria Akikawa was a small, quiet 13-year-old girl in the children's art class I taught. The class was for elementary school children, and as a junior high student, she was the eldest, but she was so reserved she didn't stand out at all, even though she was with the younger children. She always sat in a corner, trying to stay under the radar. I remembered her because something about her reminded me of my late sister, and she was about the same age as my sister when she passed away. Maria Akikawa hardly ever spoke in class. If I said something to her, she just nodded, with barely a word in response. When she absolutely had to say something, she spoke it in such a small voice, I often had to ask her to repeat herself. She seemed tense, unable to look me straight in the eye. But she loved painting, and the expression in her eyes radically transformed whenever she held a brush and was working on a canvas. Her gaze became focused, her eyes filled with an intense gleam, and her paintings were quite appealing. Not skilled, exactly, but eye-catching. Her use of colors was especially unique. All in all, a curious sort of girl. Her glossy black hair fell straight down, her features as lovely as a doll's. So beautiful, in fact, when you looked at her whole face, there was the sense of it being detached from reality. Her features were objectively attractive, but most people would hesitate to label her beautiful. Something, perhaps that special, raw, unpolished aspect that certain young girls exude in adolescence, interfered with the flow of beauty that should have been there. But someday that blockage might be removed, and she would turn into a truly lovely girl. That was still a ways off, though. Now that I thought of it, my sister's features were similar in that way. I often used to think she didn't appear as beautiful as I knew she could be. So Maria Akikawa might be your real daughter, and she lives in the house across the valley, I said, and I'm to paint a portrait with her as a model. That's what you're asking?
I'd prefer to see it as a request rather than that I'm commissioning the work. And if you're okay with it, once the painting is finished, I'd like to buy it and hang it on the wall in this house. That's what I want. Or rather, what I'm requesting.
Still, there was something about all this I couldn't quite swallow. I had a faint apprehension that things wouldn't simply end there. And that's it? That's all you want? I asked. Menshiki slowly inhaled and breathed out.
Honestly, there's one other thing I'd like you to do.
Which is a very small thing.
His voice was quiet, but with a certain force behind it.
When she's sitting for the portrait, I'd like to visit you. Make it seem like I just happened to stop by. Once is enough, and it can be for just a short time, I don't mind. Just let me be in the same room as her, and breathe the same air. I won't ask for anything more, and I can assure you I won't do anything to get in your way.
I thought about it, and the more I did, the more uncomfortable I felt. I've never been cut out to act as an intermediary. I don't enjoy getting caught up in the flow of somebody else's strong emotions, no matter what emotions they might be. The role didn't suit me, but the fact was that I also wanted to do something for Menshiki,
I had to think carefully about my reply. "We can talk about that later on," I said. "The first thing is whether or not Maria will agree to sit for the painting. That's the first step. She's a very quiet girl, like a bashful cat. She might not want to model. Or else her parents might not give permission. They don't really know my background, so they'll be pretty wary, I would imagine."
"I know Mr. Matsushima very well, the man who runs the Arts and Culture Center," Manshiki said coolly. "And I'm also, coincidentally, an investor, a financial supporter of the school. I think if Mr. Matsushima puts in a good word, things will go smoothly."
"You're an upright person, an artist with a solid career, and if he recommends you, I think it will assuage any concerns that her parents might have."
He's already got it all mapped out, I thought. He's already anticipated what might happen, like the opening moves of a game of Go. Nothing coincidental about it. Manshiki went on. "Maria Akikawa's unmarried aunt takes care of her. Her father's younger sister. I believe I mentioned this before, but after Maria's mother died, this aunt came to live with them and has been like a mother to Maria. Her father is too busy with work to be very involved. So as long as the aunt is persuaded, things should work out fine. Once she agrees to have Maria model, I would expect the aunt to accompany her to your house as her guardian. There's no way she'd allow a young girl to go by herself to the house of a man living alone. But will she really give permission for Maria to model?"
"Let me handle that. As long as you agree to paint her portrait, I'll take care of any other practical issues that come up."
I had little doubt he'd be able to take care of any of these other practical issues. That was his forte. But was it good for me to get so deeply involved in those problems, all these complex interpersonal relations? Didn't Manshiki have his own plans and intentions that went beyond what he was revealing to me?
"Can I be totally honest with you?" I said. "Maybe it isn't my place to say this, but I'd like you to hear me out."
"Of course. Say whatever you want."
"Isn't it better, before you put this plan into action, that you determine whether or not Maria Akikawa really is your child? If you find out she isn't, then there's no need to go to all this trouble. It might not be easy, but there has to be a way. I think if anyone could discover that, you could. Even if I paint her portrait and it's hanging next to yours, that's not going to solve anything."
Manshiki paused before replying.
"If I wanted to scientifically determine if Maria Akikawa is related by blood to me, I could. It might take some effort, but it's not impossible. The thing is, I don't want to."
"Why not?"
"Because whether she's my child or not isn't a determining factor."
I gazed at him, mouth shut. He shook his head, his abundant white hair waving like it was fluttering in the breeze. When he spoke, his voice was calm, like he was explaining to some large, intelligent dog how to conjugate simple verbs.
"I'm not saying either way is fine. It's just that I don't feel like determining the facts. Maybe Maria Akikawa is my biological child, and maybe she isn't. But what if I do determine that she's my real child? Then what? I announce to her that I'm her real father? Try to get custody? I can't do that."
Manshiki shook his head again, rubbing his hands together on his lap like it was a cold night and he was warming himself before a fireplace. He continued.
"Maria Akikawa is living a peaceful life in that house with her father and her aunt. Yes, her mother died, but the family, despite some issues her father has, is relatively healthy and functional. She's close to her aunt. She's made a life for herself. If I suddenly appear on the scene announcing that I'm her real father, even if I could prove it scientifically, will that solve anything?" The truth will actually confuse things, and it's not going to make anyone happy, including me.
So you'd prefer to keep things the way they are, rather than let the truth come out?
Manshiki spread his hands on his lap.
In a word, yes. It took some time for me to arrive at that conclusion, but my feelings are firm. I plan to live the rest of my life holding on to the possibility that Maria Akikawa is my real child, watching from a distance as she grows up. That's enough. Even if I knew for sure she was my child, that wouldn't make me happy. The sense of loss would be all the more painful, and if I knew she wasn't my child, that would, in a different sense, also deepen the sense of loss, or maybe crush me. Either way, there's no happy result. Can you follow what I'm trying to say?
I think so, at least in theory. But if I were in your position, I'd want to know the truth. Theory aside, it's natural for people to want to know the truth.
Manshiki smiled. You're still young, so that's why you say that. When you get to be my age, you'll understand how I feel. How much loneliness the truth can cause sometimes.
So what you're after is not to know the unmitigated truth, but to hang her portrait on your wall, gaze at it every day, and ponder the possibilities. Are you sure that's enough?
Manshiki nodded. It is. Instead of a stable truth, I choose unstable possibilities. I choose to surrender myself to that instability. Do you think that's unnatural?
I did indeed, or at least I didn't see it as natural. I wouldn't go so far as to call it unhealthy, though. But that was Manshiki's problem, not mine. I glanced over at the Commendatore seated on top of the Steinway. Our eyes met. He raised both index fingers upward and spread them apart, as if to say, "Let's put that answer on hold." Then he pointed with his right index finger to a watch on his left wrist. Of course, the Commendatore wasn't wearing a watch. He was just pointing to where one would be. And of course, what that meant was, we should be leaving soon. The Commendatore's advice to me, as well as a warning, I decided to heed it. Could I have a little time to get back to you on this? It's a delicate matter, and I need time to consider it.
Manshiki held up his hands from his lap.
Of course. Consider it as long as you'd like. I'm not trying to rush you. I know I may be asking too much.
I stood up and thanked him for the dinner.
Ah, there's one thing I forgot to tell you, Manshiki said, as if suddenly remembering. It's about Tomohiko Amada. We talked earlier, didn't we, about how he'd studied abroad in Austria? About how, just before World War II broke out, he rushed back home?
Yes, I remember.
I researched it a bit. I'm interested, too, in what was behind all that. It happened a long time ago, and I don't have all the facts, but there were rumors then of some sort of scandal.
A scandal?
That's right. Amada was apparently caught up in an aborted assassination attempt in Vienna. It turned into a political crisis, and the Japanese embassy in Berlin got involved and secreted him back to Japan, according to certain rumors. This was right after the Anschluss. You know about the Anschluss, I assume?
That was when Germany annexed Austria in 1938.
Correct. Hitler incorporated Austria into Germany. There was a lot of chaos, and the Nazis finally took over all of Austria pretty much by force, and the nation of Austria vanished. This was in March 1938. The place was in turmoil, and in the confusion of the moment, a lot of people were murdered. Assassinated or murdered and made to look like suicides, or else sent to concentration camps. It was during this time that Tomohiko Amada studied in Vienna. Rumor had it that he fell in love with an Austrian woman
and got mixed up with an underground resistance group comprised largely of college students who plotted to assassinate a high-ranking Nazi official. Not the sort of thing either the German government or the Japanese government would condone, for they'd signed a mutual defense pact only a year and a half before this, and the relationship between the two countries was growing closer all the time. Both were dead set on avoiding anything that would hinder their pact. Though Tomohiko Amada was still young, he had already made a name for himself as an artist in Japan, and his father was a large landowner, a locally politically influential person. A person like that couldn't just be secretly blotted out.
So Tomohiko Amada was sent back to Japan?
Correct. Rescued is more like it. Thanks to the political considerations of higher-ups, he narrowly escaped getting killed. If the Gestapo had gotten hold of him under suspicion of something that serious, even if they hadn't had any clear-cut evidence, that would have been the end of him.
But the assassination didn't happen?
No, it was abortive. There was an informant in the group, and the plan was leaked to the Gestapo. There was a wholesale arrest of the members.
There would have been a real uproar if they'd gone through with it.
The strange thing is, there was no talk of it at the time, Manshiki said. There were whispers about a scandal, but there doesn't seem to be any public record of it. For various reasons, it was covered up.
So the Commendatore in the painting, killing Commendatore, might represent that Nazi official. The painting might be a hypothetical depiction of the assassination that never actually happened in Vienna in 1938. Amada and his lover were connected with this plot, and then it was discovered by the authorities. The two of them were torn apart, and the woman most likely killed. And after he returned to Japan, Amada transferred that horrific experience in Vienna onto the very symbolic canvas of a Japanese-style painting, adapting it, in other words, into a scene from the Asuka period set over 1,000 years ago. Killing Commendatore was a painting Tomohiko Amada painted for himself alone. He felt compelled for his own sake to paint it to preserve that awful, bloody memory from his youth, which is precisely why he never made the painting public, why he wrapped it up tightly and hid it away in the attic. Perhaps that incident in Vienna was one reason he made a clean break with his career as an artist of Western paintings and converted to Japanese-style painting. He might have wanted to decisively separate himself from the self he used to be.
How did you find out about all this? I asked. It didn't take a lot of effort on my part. I asked an organization run by an acquaintance to investigate it for me, but it happened such a long time ago, and they can't be held responsible for how much of it is really true. They did check with multiple sources, though, so I think the information can basically be trusted.
Tomohiko Amada had an Austrian lover. She was a member of an underground resistance group, and he was involved in that assassination plot. Manshiki inclined his head a bit and then spoke.
If that's true, then it's a pretty dramatic series of events, but most of the people involved are dead by now, so there's no way for us to really know what happened. Facts have a tendency to get embellished, too. At any rate, though, it's pretty melodramatic.
No one knows how deeply he was involved in that plot?
No, we don't know. I've just given it my own dramatic touch. Amada was deported from Vienna, bid his lover farewell, or maybe wasn't even able to do that, was put on a ship in Bremen, and returned to Japan. During the war, he remained silent, holed up in rural Aso, then debuted as a painter of Japanese-style paintings soon after the end of the war, which took people by complete surprise. Another pretty dramatic development. Thus ended the story of Tomohiko Amada.
The same black infinity I'd arrived in was quietly awaiting me in front of the house. A faint drizzle was still intermittently falling, the air wet and chilly. The season when you needed a coat was just around the corner.
"Thank you so much for coming," Menshiki said. "My thanks, too, to the Commendatore."
"It is I who should be doing the thanking," the Commendatore murmured in my ear. His voice, of course, was only for me to hear. I thanked Menshiki once more for dinner. "It was an amazing meal," I said. "I couldn't be more satisfied." The Commendatore seemed grateful as well.
"I hope bringing up all of those boring details after dinner didn't spoil the evening," Menshiki said.
"Not at all. But about your request, I need some time to think about it."
"Of course.
It takes me time to consider things."
"It's the same for me," Menshiki said. "My motto is, thinking three times is better than two. And if time allows, thinking four times is better than three."
The driver had the rear door open, waiting. I got inside. The Commendatore should have boarded at the same time, though I didn't see him. The car started up the asphalt slope, drove out the open gate, then proceeded slowly down the mountain. Once the white mansion disappeared from view, everything that happened that night seemed like part of a dream. It was getting harder to distinguish what was normal from what was not, what was real and what was not.
"What you can see is real," the Commendatore whispered in my ear. "What you need to do is open your eyes wide and look at it. You can judge it later on."
Even with my eyes wide open, there could be many things I was overlooking, I thought. I may have actually murmured this aloud, since the chauffeur shot me a glance in the rearview mirror. I closed my eyes and leaned back against the seat, and thought this: how wonderful it would be to put off judging things forever. I got home a little before 10 p.m., I brushed my teeth in the bathroom, changed into pajamas, slid into bed, and fell right asleep. Predictably, I had a million dreams, all of them strange, disconcerting. Swastika flags flying over the streets of Vienna, a huge passenger ship easing out of Bremen Harbor, a brass band playing on the pier, Bluebeard's unopened room, Menshiki playing the Steinway. Chapter 26. The composition couldn't be improved. 2 days later, I got a call from my agent in Tokyo. They'd received the transfer of funds from Mr. Menshiki, the payment for the painting, and after taking the agent's fee out of it, the rest had been deposited into my bank account. When I heard the total amount, I was astonished. It was much higher than what I'd originally heard. "The finished painting was better than he'd anticipated, so we added a bonus. There was a message from Mr. Menshiki requesting that you accept this as a token of his gratitude," my agent said. I groaned faintly, but no words would come. "I haven't seen the actual painting, though Mr. Menshiki attached a photo. From the photo, at least, it looks like an amazing work. Something that goes beyond the boundaries of portrait painting, yet remains a convincing portrait." I thanked him and hung up. A little while later, my girlfriend called. Did I mind if she came over tomorrow morning? That would be fine, I told her. Friday was when I taught art class, but I'd have enough time to make it.
"Did you have dinner at Mr. Menshiki's place?" she asked.
"Yes, a really excellent meal."
"Did it taste good?"
"It was amazing. The wine was great, too, and the food was outstanding."
"What was the house like inside?"
"Beautiful," I said. "It'd take me half a day to describe it all."
"Could you tell me all about it when I see you?"
"Before or after?"
"After's good," she said simply.
After I hung up the phone, I went into the studio and looked at Tomohiko Amada's Killing Commendatore. I'd seen it so many times, But now, after what Manshiki told me, it took on a strangely graphic reality. This was not simply some historical picture of a past event reproduced in an old-fashioned format. It felt, from the expressions and movements of each of the four characters, excluding Longface, like you could read their reactions to the situation. The young man piercing the commendatore with his long sword was perfectly expressionless. He'd shut away his heart, hiding his emotions. In the commendatore's face, one could read the agony as his chest was stabbed, but also a sense of pure surprise, the sense of how could this possibly be happening? The young woman watching this take place in the opera, this character is Donna Anna, was torn apart by violently conflicting emotions. Her lovely face was contorted in anguish, her lovely white hand held to her mouth. The stocky man, a servant by the look of him, Leporello, was gasping for breath, gazing up at the sky. His hand was stretched out as if trying to reach something. The organization was perfect. The composition couldn't be improved. It was a superb, polished arrangement. Each character maintained a vivid dynamism in their actions, instantaneously frozen in time. And now I saw the events of the aborted assassination that may have occurred in 1938 Vienna, overlaying the painting. The commendatore was dressed not in Oscar period costume, but in a Nazi uniform. Maybe the black uniform of the SS. And in his chest was a saber, or perhaps a dagger. Perhaps the one stabbing him was Tomohiko Amata himself. And who was the woman gasping nearby? Was this Amata's Austrian lover? And what was it that was rending her heart in two like that? I sat on the stool, gazing for a long time at killing Commendatore. My imagination could come up with all sorts of allegories and messages contained therein, but these were, in the final analysis, nothing more than unsubstantiated hypotheses. The background, what I took as background, that is, that Manshiki had talked about, was not historical fact, but nothing more than rumor, or else just a melodrama. Everything remained on the level of perhaps. A thought suddenly struck me. I wish my sister were here. If Komi were with me, I'd tell her everything that had happened, and she'd listen quietly, adding an occasional short question. Even with an incomprehensible mixed-up story like this, I doubt she'd frown or show any surprise. Her calm, thoughtful expression wouldn't change. And after I finished, she'd pause, then give me some useful advice. Ever since we were little, we'd had that kind of interaction. But I realized now she'd never come to me for advice. As far as I could recall, that had never happened. Why? Maybe she didn't have any major emotional issues? Or maybe she'd decided asking me for advice wasn't going to help? Maybe both, or half of each. But even if she had been healthy and hadn't died at 12, the intimate brother-sister relationship we had shared might not have lasted. Komi might have ended up marrying some boring guy, gone to live in a town far away, been run ragged by everyday life, exhausted by raising children, lost her sparkle, and no longer retained the energy to give me advice. No one could say how our lives would have worked out. The problems my wife and I had had might have stemmed from me unconsciously wanting Yuzu to stand in for Komi. That was never my intention, of course. But now that I thought of it, ever since I lost my sister, I may have been seeking, somewhere inside me, a substitute partner I could lean on whenever I was struggling. Needless to say, though, Yuzu wasn't Komi. Their positions and roles were vastly different, and so was the history we'd shared. As I thought about this,
I remembered the visit I'd made to Yuzu's parents' home in Kinuta and Setagaya in Tokyo before we got married. Yuzu's father was the branch manager of a large bank. His son, Yuzu's older brother, was also a banker and worked for the same bank. Both were graduates of the elite economics department of Tokyo University. There seemed to be a lot of bankers in her family. I wanted to marry Yuzu, and of course she wanted to marry me too, and the visit was for me to convey my intentions to her parents. Any way you looked at it, it was hard to call the half-hour interview I had with her father a friendly visit. I was an unknown artist who worked part-time painting portraits and didn't make what could be called a regular income. A guy with little in the way of future prospects. Not at all the sort of man a top banker like her father would view favorably. I'd anticipated this ahead of time and was dead set on not losing my cool no matter what he said or how much criticism he heaped upon me. And I was basically the kind of person who could put up with a lot. Yet as I listened to her father's long-winded sermon, a kind of physical revulsion welled up in me, and I lost it. I felt sick, like I was going to throw up. I stood up before he'd finished and said, "I'm sorry, but I need to use the bathroom." I knelt down in front of the toilet bowl, trying to vomit up the contents of my stomach, but I couldn't vomit, because there was hardly anything in my stomach. Even the gastric juices wouldn't come out. I took some deep breaths and calmed down. I gargled with water to get rid of the bad taste in my mouth, wiped the sweat from my face with a handkerchief, and went back to the living room. "Are you all right?" Yuzu asked, looking concerned. I must have looked awful.
"A successful marriage is up to the people involved, but I can tell you, this one won't last long. 4, 5 years at the most."
These were her father's parting words to me that day. I didn't respond. His spiteful words stayed with me, a kind of curse that remained for a long time to come. Her parents never did agree to our marriage, but we went ahead and registered it and officially became a married couple. By this time, I had very little contact with my own parents. Yuzu and I didn't have a wedding ceremony. Our friends rented a small place and held a simple party to celebrate, but that was it. The person who did the most to make that happen was Masahiko, who was always good at taking care of others. Despite the inauspicious beginning, we were happy. At least for the first few years, we were definitely happy together. For 4 or 5 years, we had no problems between us. But then, like a huge cruising ship in the middle of the ocean turning its rudder, there was a gradual change. I still don't know why. I can't even pinpoint when things began to move in a different direction. What she hoped for in marriage and what I was looking for must have been different, and that gap only grew more pronounced over time. And then, before I knew it, she was seeing another man. In the end, our marriage only lasted some 6 years. I imagine that when her father learned that our marriage had failed, he'd chuckled to himself and thought, "I told you so," though we had stayed together a year or two beyond what he'd predicted. It must have pleased him no end that Yuzu had left me. After we'd broken up, had Yuzu reconciled with her family? I had no way of knowing, and didn't really want to know at that point. This was her business, not mine. But still her father's curse continued to hang over me. Even now, I sensed the vague weight of its presence. I'd been hurt more than I cared to admit, and had bled. Like the pierced heart of the Commendatore in Tomohiko Amada's painting. Late afternoon came on, and with it, the early autumn twilight. The sky turned dark in the twinkling of an eye, the glossy black crows squawking their way across the valley, heading for their roosts. I went out on the terrace, leaned against the railing, and gazed over at Manshiki's house across the way.
Several mercury lights were on in his garden, the whiteness of the house rising up in the dusk. I pictured Menshiki out there every night, searching through his high-powered binoculars for Maria Akikawa. He'd purchased that white house almost by force for the sole purpose of doing that. Spent a huge amount of money, made a great deal of effort, all for an overly large house that didn't suit his tastes. And strangely enough, at least to me it felt strange, I'd begun to feel a closeness to Menshiki, a closeness I'd never felt to anyone before. An affinity, no, a sense of solidarity, really. In a sense, we were very similar. That's what I thought. The two of us were motivated not by what we had got hold of, or were trying to get, but by what we'd lost, what we did not now have. I can't say I understood his actions. They were beyond my comprehension, but I could understand what had spurred him on. I went to the kitchen, took the single malt that Masahiko had given me, and poured a glass on the rocks. I carried the drink out to the living room sofa and selected a record of a Schubert string quartet from Tomohiko Amada's collection and put it on the turntable. A piece titled Rosamunda, the same music that had been playing in Menshiki's study. I listened to the music, occasionally clinking the ice in my glass. The commendatore never showed up that day. Maybe, like the horned owl, he was quietly resting up in the attic. Even ideas needed some time off. I didn't do any painting that day either. I needed some time off as well. I raised my glass to the commendatore. Chapter 27. Even though you remember exactly what it looked like. When my girlfriend came over, I told her all about the dinner party at Menshiki's, leaving out, of course, any mention of Maria Akikawa, the high-powered binoculars, and the commendatore having secretly accompanied me. What I described was the dinner menu, the way the rooms were laid out in the house, the kind of furniture, safe subjects. We were in bed, completely naked, after making love for about a half hour. At first, it was hard to relax, knowing that the commendatore must be observing us, but as we got into it, I forgot all about him. If he wanted to watch, let him. Like a rabid sports fan is dying to know how his favorite team scored in the game the night before, my girlfriend panted over every detail of the dishes we had at dinner. I painstakingly went over the details, as far as I could remember them, from the hors d'oeuvres to dessert, from the wine to the coffee, even the tableware. I've always been blessed with great visual recall. If I focus on something, even a trivial thing, I can recall the minutest details, even after time has passed. I could reproduce the special features of every dish that was served, as if I were doing a quick sketch. She listened to my descriptions, a spellbound look in her eyes, at times actually gulping back her desire. "Sounds amazing," she said dreamily. "Someday I'd love to have a wonderful meal like that." "To tell the truth, though, I don't remember much of what it tasted like," I said. "You don't remember how the food tasted? But you liked it, right?" "Yes, it was delicious. That much I remember, but I can't recall the flavors, can't explain it in words." "Even though you remember exactly what it looked like?" "I could reproduce exactly what it looked like. I'm a painter, it's what I do, but I can't explain what went into it. Maybe a writer would be able to describe the flavors." "Weird," she said. "So even when we do this together, you could paint a painting of it later on, but you wouldn't be able to reproduce the feeling in words?" I gathered my thoughts. "You're talking about sexual pleasure?"
"Yes."
You may be right. But I think describing the flavor of a dish is harder than describing sexual pleasure."
"So what you're saying," she said,
in a voice as chilly as an early winter nightfall, is that the taste of the dishes Mr. Manshiki served you is more exquisite and deeper than the sexual pleasure I provide? That's not what I'm saying, I said hurriedly. It's not a comparison of the quality of the two, but a question of the degree of difficulty of explaining them, in a technical sense. All right, she said. What I give you isn't so bad, is it? In a technical sense? Of course, I said. It's amazing, in a technical sense, and all other senses, so amazing I couldn't paint it. Truthfully, the physical pleasure she provided me left nothing to be desired. Up till then, I'd had sexual relationships with a number of women, not so many I could brag about it, but her vagina was more exquisite, more wondrously varied, than any other I'd ever known. And it was a deplorable thing that it had lain there, unused, for so many years. When I told her this, she didn't look as dissatisfied as you might have thought. Really? Really. She looked at me, dubiously, then seemed to take me at my word. So, did he show you the garage? She asked. The garage? His legendary garage with its four British cars. No, I didn't see it, I said. It's such a huge place, and I didn't get a chance to see the garage. Hmm, she said. You didn't ask him if he really does own a Jaguar XKE? No, I didn't think of it. I mean, I'm not really into cars. You're happy with a used Corolla station wagon? You got it. I'd love to be able to touch a Jaguar XKE sometime. It's such a gorgeous car. I've been in love with that car ever since I saw it in a film with Audrey Hepburn and Peter O'Toole when I was a child. Peter O'Toole was driving a bright, shiny Jaguar E. Now what color was it? Yellow, as I recall. Her thoughts drifted to that sports car she'd seen as a young girl, while what came to my mind was that Subaru Forester. The white Subaru parked in the parking lot on the edge of that tiny town along the coast in Miyagi. Not a particularly attractive vehicle, a typical small SUV, a squat little utilitarian machine. I doubt there'd be many people who would unconsciously feel like touching it, unlike with a Jaguar XKE. So you didn't get to see the greenhouse or the gym either? She asked me. She was talking about Manshiki's house again. No such luck. Didn't get to see the greenhouse, the gym, or the laundry room, the maid's quarters, the kitchen, or the spacious walk-in closet, or the game room with the billiard table. He didn't show them to me. That evening, Manshiki had an important matter he had to talk with me about. He was far too preoccupied to give me a leisurely tour of the house. Does he really have a huge walk-in closet and a game room with a billiard table? I don't know. I'm just guessing. It wouldn't be strange if he did, though. He didn't show you any of the other rooms besides the study? Yeah, it's not like I'm interested in interior design. What he showed me were the foyer, the living room, the study, and the dining room. You didn't try to spot Bluebeard's secret chamber? Didn't have the chance to, and I wasn't about to ask Manshiki, by the way, where is the famous Bluebeard's secret chamber? She shook her head a few times, clicking her tongue in frustration. I tell you, that's what's wrong with men. Don't you have any curiosity? If it were me, I'd want to see every nook and cranny. The things men and women are curious about must be different. It seems like it, she said. Resigned to it. But that's okay. I should be happy to have gotten a lot of new info about the interior of Mr. Manshiki's house. I was getting increasingly uneasy. Getting information is one thing, but it wouldn't be good if this got out to others. Through your jungle grapevine. It's all right. No need for you to worry about every little thing, she said cheerily. She took my hand and guided it to her clitoris. In this way, our two spheres of curiosity once more significantly overlapped. I still had time before I had to go teach, At that point, I thought I heard the bell in the studio faintly ringing, but I was probably just hearing things. After she drove away in the red Mini just before 3, I went into the studio and picked up the bell from the shelf. I couldn't see anything different about it. It had just been quietly lying there. I looked around, but the Commendatore was nowhere to be seen. I went over to the canvas, sat down on the stool, and gazed at the portrait of the man with the white Subaru Forester that I'd begun. I wanted to consider the direction I should take it in now, but here I made an unexpected discovery. The painting was already complete. Needless to say, the painting was still unfinished. I had a few ideas I planned to incorporate into it. At this point, the painting was nothing more than a rough prototype of the man's face, done with the 3 colors I'd mixed, the colors riotously slapped on over the rough charcoal sketch. In my eyes, of course, I could detect the ideal form of the man with the white Subaru Forester. His face was there in the painting in a latent trompe l'oeil type of way, but this was only visible to me. It was, at this point, only the foundation for a painting, merely the hint and suggestion of things to come. But that man, the person I had been trying to paint from memory, was already satisfied with his taciturn form presented there, and maybe dead set against his likeness being made any clearer than it was now. "Don't you touch anything," the man was saying, or maybe commanding, from the canvas. "Don't you add a single thing more." The painting was complete as is, incomplete. The man actually existed completely in that inchoate form, a contradiction in terms, but there was no other way to describe it. And that man's hidden form looked out to me from the canvas as if signaling some hard and fast idea, trying hard to get me to understand something, but I still had no idea what that was. This man is alive, I felt, actually alive and moving. The paint on the picture was still wet, but I took the canvas down from the easel, turned it facing away, and propped it up against the studio wall, careful not to get paint on the wall. It was harder and harder for me to stand seeing the painting. There was something ominous about it, something I shouldn't know about. Hovering around the painting was the air of a fishing port. In that air was a mix of smells, the smell of the tide, of fish scales, of diesel engines, of fishing boats. Flocks of birds were screeching, slowly circling on the strong wind. The black golf cap of a middle-aged man who'd probably never played a round of golf in his life. The darkly tanned face, the stringy nape of the neck, the short clipped hair mixed with gray. The well-used leather jacket. The clatter of knives and forks in the restaurant, that impersonal sound found at chain restaurants around the world. And the white Subaru Forester quietly parked in the lot out front. The sticker of a Marlin on the rear bumper. "Hit me," the woman had said in the middle of sex. Her fingernails were digging deep into my back. There was a strong smell of sweat. I did as she asked, smacking her face with an open hand. "Not like that. Don't hold back. Hit me harder," the woman said, shaking her head violently. "Harder, much harder. Really hit me. I don't care if there's a bruise, hard enough so my nose bleeds." I had no desire to hit her. I never had those kind of violent tendencies, hardly any at all. But she was seriously hoping I would seriously hit her. What she needed was real pain. So I reluctantly hit her again, a little harder this time. Hard enough to leave a red mark on her. Every time I struck her, her flesh squeezed my penis like a vice, like a starving animal pouncing on some food. "Would you choke me a little?" she whispered a little while later. "Use this." The sound seemed to be coming from another realm. She pulled out a white bathrobe belt from under her pillow. She'd had it there, ready to use. I refused. I could never do something like that. It was too dangerous. Mess up, and she could die.
"Just pretend," she pleaded, gasping. "You don't need to really choke me. Just pretend like you are. Wrap this around my neck and tighten it a little."
I couldn't refuse. The impersonal clatter of silverware in a chain restaurant. I shook my head, trying to drive away those memories. It was an incident I didn't care to recall, a memory I'd like to throw away and never have again. But the feel of that bathrobe belt lingered in my hands, the way her neck felt too. For whatever reason, these stayed with me. And this man knew. Where I'd been the night before, what I'd done, what I'd been thinking. What should I do with this painting? Keep it here in the studio, turned toward the wall? Even turned around like that, it still made me uneasy. The only other place to keep it was the attic, the same place Tomohiko Amada had hidden away killing Commendatore, the place to hide away what was in your heart. In my mind, the words I'd spoken aloud came back to me. I could reproduce exactly what it looked like. I'm a painter. It's what I do. But I can't explain what went into it. All sorts of things I couldn't explain were insidiously grabbing hold of me. Tomohiko Amada's killing Commendatore that I'd discovered in the attic, the strange bell left behind inside the gaping stone chamber in the woods, the idea that appeared to me in the guise of the Commendatore and the middle-aged man with the white Subaru Forester, and that odd white-haired person who lived across the valley. Menshiki seemed to be enlisting me into some kind of plan he had in mind. The whirlpool swirling around me was gradually picking up speed, and there was no way for me to turn back. It was too late. That whirlpool was totally soundless, and that weird silence had me scared.
Chapter 28. Franz Kafka was quite fond of slopes. That evening, I taught a children's art class. The assignment that day was to do rough sketches of people. The children worked in pairs, selecting the type of drawing instruments they wanted from the ones the school had prepared ahead of time, charcoal or various types of soft pencils, and took turns sketching each other in their notebooks. They were limited to 15 minutes per drawing. I used a kitchen timer to accurately time them. They were supposed to use an eraser as little as they could and limit themselves to one sheet of paper if possible. One by one, the children then came to the front of the class, showed us their sketches, and got feedback from the other children. It was a small class, and the atmosphere was congenial. Afterward, I went forward and taught them some simple techniques for rough sketches. I explained in general the difference between croquis, rough sketches, and dessin. A dessin is more of a blueprint for a painting and requires a certain accuracy. Compared with that, a croquis is a free first impression. You get an impression in your mind and trace the rough outline of it before it disappears. More than accuracy, croquis require balance and speed. Many famous painters actually weren't very skilled at doing croquis. I've always prided myself on being good at drawing these kind of quick sketches. Finally, I chose one of the children to model for me, and did a rough sketch of her on the blackboard in white chalk to show them an actual example.
"Wow, you're so fast. It looks just like her,"
the children called out, impressed. One of a teacher's important duties is to get children to be genuinely impressed. Next, I had them change partners and do another croquis, and the second time, they were much improved. They absorbed knowledge quickly. This time, the instructor was impressed. Of course, some of them were better than others, but that didn't matter. What I was teaching them was less how to draw
than a way to view the world. On this day, I selected Maria Akikawa, intentionally, of course, to serve as model when I drew an example. I did a simple sketch of her from the waist up on the blackboard. It wasn't exactly a croquis,